Speaking of personal responsibility, this book.
It's got a lot of personal responsibility, I think, in
a lot
of ways.
Not for the villain.
No, he's a giant douchebag.
He's the worst.
Yeah, he really is. But speaking of villains, I'm Rick Fox. I am an author here in Nashville, and I am a giant toad demon in a trench coat.
And I'm Michael Smith. I'm an accountant and writer here in Nashville, and I am a blonde badass in uniform.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I usually think of short as my first Murphy descriptor, but blonde badass does fit. Yeah, yeah.
She's very blonde through all of these books, she's very which is blonde. Not how I imagine her in my head at all. However,
I am Alana Jones. I'm also a writer here in Nashville, and I am a pizza-loving fairy.
And we're opinionated. Stormfront, and by today I mean 3 months ago, because somehow my
because
computer
Rick
progressed.
Sucks.
Hey, I can't control my computer.
Harry balls. Maybe Harry's balls.
No,
in this case.
No. Too far. anyway, we read Stormfront a few months ago, and Michael and I reviewed it, but unfortunately that review has been lost to my computer's ability to corrupt files. So,
think it was Harry's fault.
I mean, he does screw up technology.
It is technology.
That is his entire thing.
You should probably do multiple backup copies of any of these books.
You know, actually, now that I think about it, that is very appropriate. And yes, I should absolutely do that.
You should do that.
but yeah, so we're here to talk about Stormfront. It's been a few months, so...
I've forgotten everything.
Right. I reread the entire thing last night, but it's been a little while for co-host, and my memory is notoriously poor. So if we get things a little bit out of order, forgive us for that, but it should be mostly fine. I'm sure the last 2 days, yeah.
Ugh.
I did 6 hours. Actually, that was the thing I was talking about snapping to chair, is that I listened to 6 hours of it at like normal speed. And it was fine. Like, I had no issues with it. It's a very well-paced book, if nothing else.
There is that. Yeah. It does, about 30 pages in, 50 pages in, it picks up, and it's easy to just go ahead and read.
Mm-hmm. It's a quick breeze of a read.
Yeah. I fall out of the story when I start thinking about it critically in any way.
We'll get to that.
But...
anyway.
Yeah.
So, I will... go ahead and just do both characters and the story, since I'm the only one that's read it the most recently. We've got our main character, Harry. He is a wizard in Chicago. He runs a private detective service, and he gets a lot of crank calls, and he's not happy about it. At the moment, he is chronically broke. And he is...
because he's a wizard in Chicago, where he gets a lot of prank calls.
Right, exactly. Well, mostly because he doesn't use his wizarding... the way that someone would if they wanted to make money.
Right.
I think that Harry wants to make the world a better place as one of the way that he sees what his responsibility is with his magic is to make the world a better place. And the way that for some reason he thinks that he can do that is by being a private detective. So he lives in the basement of a house and is chronically broke and is currently in desperate need of rent money. So when he gets two jobs in one day, he kind of has to take them.
Yep.
Harry is a character that we are going to discuss thoroughly through this podcast, I am sure, so I won't spend too much more time on him. The other main character or characters of this book are Murphy. She is a detective lieutenant. She is a tiny badass who will...
Who's blonde.
She takes absolutely no shit. And she gives Harry a hard time, and he gives it right back to her, and that's the basis
Harry
of their friendship.
She takes no shit and gives Harry shit.
Correct.
And that's about their friendship.
It is. But she is the main source of his money, because she has to deal with all of the supernatural crap that goes down in Chicago, because she's essentially low man on the police force totem pole, because of her lack of ability to take shit, I think. You've got her. Then the other side of the law is John Marcone. He is the crime boss of the city, and he is a he's an interesting crime boss in that he is kind of, to me, the definition of lawful evil.
Yeah, for sure.
He is keeping order in the city's crime. He is, like, there's no, he doesn't allow anything to happen to children. Like, that's one of his strong rules that comes up later in different books. But he has kept crime, like, from spreading off of the streets. And there's just a lot that is going on with John. But he is a ruthless monster.
Yeah.
All the same.
Yeah.
He's not doing it out of the good of the heart.
But he's a calculating...
Correct. That's the perfect
word for it. He's a calculating monster more than a ruthless monster.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Will he be ruthless in a situation where he has calculated that somebody needs to be eliminated? Yeah. Right. Absolutely. Right. But ruthless isn't his first quality. It's planning. It's calculation. It's who has the most power and how do I get it from them? Right. Like,
he absolutely does what he feels is necessary under any circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
And he's putting himself in a position where he has to do a lot of necessary things, I think. But
yeah. Well, there's that.
Yeah. So we also have Harry's other job in this book, Monica Sells. She is a housewife that has lost her husband somehow, and she collects little tiny plastic cows that are very tacky, and that's kind of adorable.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise,
she's kind of a non-entity.
She has a big part to play in the reveal of the bad guy in this book. Because you get a look under what Harry sees on the surface of her.
She's the desperate housewife trope.
In a lot of ways, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Only less sexy.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Well, no, it's Harry, so she's...
Well, she has boobs, so...
Sexy, I don't think, is the word that is used to describe her. She is, but housewife.
In terms of the reveal.
Right, right.
Like, but there's that very much a... housewife who doesn't have a lot of power, who knows a lot of stuff, but doesn't know how to use it to her advantage.
Correct. Yeah.
Because she just is too hemmed in by the role that she's taken. Like, mm-hmm. the mother and the wife and the, like...
And the situation of danger she's in. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not right. just the role necessarily, but it's also the fact that, well, I'll go ahead and get into the villain. Her husband has become a sorcerer, which is technically different from a wizard, but a sorcerer, and he is mass producing a drug called Three Eye, and his wife is terrified of him, and that's why she drags Harry into this whole situation.
Of course, she doesn't tell Harry that because her husband is a wizard, or her husband is a sorcerer, and she doesn't want to end up dead.
Yeah, exactly. But
details.
Yeah. So let's see. Is there anyone else that really needs to? Oh, Susan.
There's also Susan.
Yeah.
And Toad Demon.
Well, Toad Demon isn't really a character.
He shows up a couple of times.
Yeah, he is, but he doesn't really have
more
a personality.
Of an
He's just kind
than
of a
fair
bitey
character.
Monster.
There. Well, okay. That's
oh, Bob. I should talk about Bob.
Oh,
Bob
definitely Bob.
But Susan is a reporter who works for the Midwestern Arcane. The Arcane is a newspaper that is somewhere.
It's a tabloid.
It's a tabloid, but you know,
they just sometimes get stuff right.
Exactly. Every now and it's one of those like National Enquirer types, but
very
it is much more focused on magic. And mm-hmm. because magic is real in this world, every now and then you have someone like Susan who is actually a very good reporter and who can find that kind of thing and talks about it in there. So mm-hmm. it gets some things right occasionally.
She's also all legs and very hot, so Harry's interested.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
She also likes to use that to her advantage.
Oh,
when she's looking
yeah.
for a story.
Right. I mean, you know, as you do. That is
as
one of the
do.
Reporter tropes. But Susan is also, yes, interested in Harry for reasons that are at times difficult to fathom. But it's not clear if she is interested in him for Harry or interested in him for his wizard staff. But I had to work it in there. Anyway, but Susan is the type of reporter that is always on the lookout for a story, and she finds that Harry is probably going to be a good source for the kind of story that she wants.
Yep.
But it
or they'll at least happen around him.
Exactly, which is what happens that night. But we'll get to the specifics of
night.
All that. I will talk briefly about one other character. There is Jennifer Stanton. She is a essentially a sex worker in kind of a variety of roles at different points in the story of what leads up to this book. But
yeah.
at the time the book starts, she is working for a couple who are mixed up in all of this business that Harry is investigating.
Wait, there's the other sex worker too.
Right, but she's dead when the book starts.
That's Jennifer.
Oh.
Jennifer is the one that's dead when the
Jennifer
book starts.
Jennifer is the one that's dead when it starts. What's the
she's
name of the
one that
one?
Has her heart like
yeah.
exploded
yeah.
all
right.
over
what's
the place.
Right, what's the name of the other one?
Is it like Melissa or something?
Linda Randall.
There we go. It was such a random name,
ordinary name,
super boring.
That is what this is the problem with like urban fantasy is that all the names
are
very normal.
Sound like names that you would hear anywhere.
Exactly. And so it's the opposite of the problem that fantasy has where all the names are so unfamiliar.
But also
what
sex worker picks Linda Randall as her name?
Well, yeah,
it could be anyone. And that's what you choose. Also, when was this published? Just
That would be early 2000s, I think.
That makes sense. Because they all sound like they were born in like the 70s.
But anyway, so Linda is working for a couple that is mixed up in all of the three eye business, the magical drug that's going around yep. in Chicago. Linda is, she puts up a front of someone who is constantly just horny all the time.
Yep.
Yeah.
But I think that the book gives you enough of a look under her skin that you can see that a lot of that
under
is
her skin.
Yeah. That a lot of that is a mask she puts up to deal with the very dangerous situation she's in.
Sure.
She uses her sexuality to put Harry very off balance, and Harry being Harry, that is an easy and effective tactic.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So Linda is that character. Bob, who is one of my favorite
Bob
recurring
is
characters.
The best.
He's just hilarious. Bob is a...
And the worst.
Bob is a very horny skull. Well, air spirit that lives in a skull.
He's an air... Yeah.
He is essentially Harry's arcane computer that exists to give Harry sass and...
And also recipes that for potions that Harry would never be able to remember on his own.
Correct. Like a love potion that definitely doesn't come up to complicate a situation later.
Of course not.
Right.
And definitely didn't involve tequila.
Well, it was supposed to involve champagne, but Harry's cheap. So...
Yeah.
Anyway, you've got well.
Seems like
no,
it
wait,
might
no, that's wrong.
It
was it was supposed to involve a diamond, but Harry's cheap, so it ended up having 20s. And
yeah.
Instead of champagne, the reason Bob throws in tequila is to make it basically
sleazier.
Sluttier. Yeah,
yeah.
Which is
right.
Bob's
chicks love
in
chocolate.
Yeah, exactly. Bob is a air spirit that Harry uses to basically figure out magical theory. And to make it a character instead of just a computer, it's a horny wise ass. And that's a fun combination of thing. I guess I shouldn't call him it because he definitely wants to be a he. So
yeah.
But either way.
What's the name of the big bad she vampire?
That's Bianca. Bianca is a fairly minor character in this book, but she is a recurring one. So I'll mention her somewhat.
She's definitely important to this
right.
Stories both, escalation.
Right, right.
Both Harry's bigger picture story and
mm-hmm. She is a vampire that runs a brothel. And
she's Red Court?
Yes, she's Red Court. Which the distinction between different courts isn't terribly important in this one, so I'll save that for a later one. She's a Red Court vampire that runs a brothel, and both the sex worker that is dead at the beginning of the book that kind of opens things
yep.
and Jennifer or not Jennifer because it is Jennifer
Linda
and Linda are
who is dead later in the book
right. They both work for Bianca, and so that's the reason that Harry has to go talk to her, even though Murphy definitely does not want him to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway, the plot of this book is it's a little screwy because this is, I think, more so than most Dresden books, a kind of standard detective novel with magic
right.
in it. So I'm probably going to get stuff a little bit out of order when I explain all of this, but forgive me, but I'll hit most of the major plot points. Harry is broke, so he gets two calls in one day, which is what makes it special. He's got to go deal with the police and with a Monica Sells. He goes to the police. There is a mafia enforcer and a sex worker that have both died horribly. Their hearts have exploded out of their chest.
Truly one of the most beautiful, grotesque murders I've ever read.
It is mm-hmm. exceptionally disgusting, but also, yeah, I can understand what you're saying. It's quite a tableau, I think is the word that he uses.
Yeah. And it's one of the places where butchers descriptive prose does actually shine in this book, which is not the case for this book compared to other books of his that I've read.
I'd agree with that. But they have both died, and the police want to know what happened, and so Harry is on the job consulting. After he finishes,
it was obviously magic.
Right, exactly. He knows, he doesn't know enough about doing the kind of magic that kills people to fully explain it, though, so he essentially checks out the crime scene and tells them, I'll give you some more information later. And he rushes back to his office to talk to Monica. On the way, however, he is essentially dragged into a car by mafia boss John Marcone. Mm-hmm. Marcone is there because someone is creating a magical drug on the street, and he thinks that he needs wizardly help to deal with this magical situation. And Harry, being the wizard that's in the phone book, he's the one that gets the call.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So Marcone
offers him anything he wants.
Basically, right. He offers him an absurdly good job of like thousands of dollars a month, and also he only has to work like an hour a month for him.
Yep,
it seems legit. Exactly.
I don't know that I would have been Harry in that situation. Not gonna lie, like Harry turns him down. He soul gazes him.
Right. Right. But it's before he soul gazes him that he turns him down. Like Harry, he's tempted by the offer.
Yeah, for sure.
As Who I think be? Anyone reasonably would be. But in the end of the day, he knows what John Marcone does and the cost in blood that it has attached to it. And right. So he turns John down. But the main reason that John was here was to trick Harry into a soul gaze. We don't see Harry's soul because that's not how it works. But we do see John's, and John has a terrifying, I think the way that he put it is a tiger's soul. He is someone who is very calculating, as we've already explained. We get that whole picture in kind of an instant of who this guy is. And it scares the bejesus out of Harry, but he manages to get out of the situation and threaten John anyway, as he tends to do with anything that scares him.
Yep.
But he barely makes it back to talk to Monica. Monica is, as we said, kind of a housewife. She's very jittery. She's very obviously nervous in this situation.
She does not give her actual name.
Correct.
Wisely.
But Harry kind of figures that she is just someone who is naturally nervous, doesn't really figure out that there is something dangerous going on under the surface. Mm-hmm. He makes some invalid assumptions, as I think are necessary for the beginning of a mystery novel. She sends him on the trail of Victor, who is her husband, wants him to investigate the lake house that they have out further from the city. And so that's kind of that. So Harry, from this point on, kind of charges about stupidly in a bunch of different directions, does a bunch of dumb things.
Yep.
He also manages to get a date with Susan, which he promptly forgets because
he never sleeps in this book. Like, I don't know.
He gets knocked unconscious at least once.
Yeah, that's not sleeping. I don't know that he gets more than 2 hours together of sleep through this entire mystery. And it was one of the things that bothered me in this book because, like,
okay, he actually does. It's just not at convenient times. He gets sleep when he's doing, after he does some magical research, he gets some sleep that time.
And yeah, it's like 2 or 3 hours.
After he gets a concussion, he gets a full day's rest, although it's with a concussion. So,
yeah, so
it's not,
really count,
not the best.
Okay.
But there are a couple times, but he is also like, I think he's supposed to be 25 to 29, somewhere in there for this book.
Oh, wow. He's a lot younger than I imagine.
Yeah. And so, like, you can still do that at that age and push through. I'm hitting my 30s now, and it's not working so well anymore.
I'm 22, and I have no desire.
I'm 30, and I've had no desire any point in my life to do this, so...
That's fair. Some people make poorer decisions, though.
We have discovered this.
But, so, he kind of charges about blindly in a lot of directions. This ends up with him almost having his would-be girlfriend Susan and sex worker Linda Randall meet, but that is interrupted by a gigantic toad demon.
Bummer.
Right? That would have been an interesting scene to see.
Very awkward.
The claws would have definitely come out, and I think Harry would have gotten all the scratches.
That would have been so great.
But
instead, we have a toad demon, a naked Susan on a love potion.
She's not naked. Harry's
naked. She has no underwear on.
She just makes a point that she has no underwear on. But, yeah. Anyway. A love potion gets mixed into that whole situation.
I feel like Harry has bad luck in showers too, because obviously if you're listening to this podcast, this is the first book in this series, but I'm already two or three books in, thanks to this corrupted file of Harry's. And so, like, there's at least another shower scene in a different book where Harry ends up uncomfortably naked and wet.
I feel like it happens every time.
I feel like it's in at least the first three books. There's at least one Harry shower or bath.
I can't think of any in the second book. I know
there's the sponge bath, but there's nothing that bad that happens one.
Yeah, yeah. The sponge bath does happen in that one. Anyway.
Harry has bad luck with showers, guys.
Correct. But Harry kind of charges about blindly. He gets in trouble with the police through this because they end up thinking that he's the one who has created all of this magical nonsense.
Right.
So Murphy and him are more or less on the outs. He gets deeper into this situation with...
Mostly because he won't tell Murphy anything, right. Which is right. Just like the classic trope in probably detective novels in general. Oh, yeah. I can't give you this information because it might kill you.
Right.
But
well, to be fair, it might also kill him. The White Council in this book seems to be very hush-hush about wizards existing. And so they are already very mad that he advertises himself. And so to explain the whole White Council and the rest of the world to her would theoretically put her in danger, although I think it is, mostly an excuse to not give Murphy information that she needs.
Right.
Anyway, I'm trying to think of specific big events that really matter. Harry also investigates the vampire that we mentioned, Bianca. Mm-hmm. That situation goes very poorly for him, and he makes a longtime enemy through his interactions with her.
Yeah.
But also, we can get into that scene specifically when you get through the summary.
Right.
But the long-term ramifications of that are so strange to me in context of the scene. But... Mm-hmm.
The final say is that Harry ends up squishing a giant scorpion with an elevator to save Murphy, who thinks that he is the bad guy, and then jetting out to go fight a sorcerer, essentially.
Yep. Who's high on sex and drugs.
Who's very high on sex, drugs, and black magic, which the further you get into the series, the more it makes sense why he becomes a cackling, like, insane villain. But in this book, it's not thoroughly explained what black magic does to a person, so he just comes off as a very cliche, dialogue-heavy villain.
Yep. He's really boring.
He is pretty bad. But you don't see a lot of him, so that doesn't, hurt too bad. Anyway, Harry ends up setting a place on fire, as he happens to do a lot.
Oh, you know who you didn't mention and who is important in this book is the knight.
Oh, yeah. Morgan.
Morgan.
He's not a knight. He's a warden.
Oh, he's the warden. Yeah. That's right. Morgan drives Harry absolutely nuts.
Correct.
And ends up giving him mouth to mouth in this last fire scene.
Yeah.
Which Harry almost dies in. So
if Marcone is lawful evil, then Morgan is lawful neutral.
Good. Oh, you think neutral?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
I think that at one point he probably was lawful good, but he
Michael is
much
lawful
more.
Good.
Michael is absolutely lawful good.
Morgan is lawful evil.
Yeah.
Or lawful neutral, and Marcone is lawful good. Weird. Yeah. That they all have
lawful there. There's a lot of chaotic characters.
No, they're all M's. We have Marcone, Morgan, and Michael, and
that's
have
a good point.
Lawful evil, lawful neutral, lawful good.
That's an interesting point. Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Anyway, Harry burns down a building and
almost dies
and saves the day, which is pretty par for the course for a Dresden climax.
Yep.
Everything kind of works out mostly, although there are certain long-term ramifications of his actions, like people thinking that he's working for John, even though he's not. But yeah, at the end of the day, he's saved the day, unraveled the mystery, killed the bad guy, and actually gotten the girl for once.
Still kind of broke.
Yeah, still very, very broke, and maybe probably extra broke because Murphy now is...
not going to give him any jobs.
Not real happy about employing him, but... At the end of the day, he's still alive, and that's much better than most of the outcomes that could have happened through this book. So, now that I've talked a lot, what do you guys think of this book overall?
Oh, dear.
I actually enjoyed it, despite myself. I'm like, not that it's a horrible book, and like, there's no way that anyone would like it, but there were moments in it that I was like, this is ridiculous and I hate this, but overall I actually found myself really pulled in by it. I mostly read it honestly while I was at work, and I'm a bartender. There was no one at the bar, and I would just pick it up and read it. But it ended up being more than just a way to pass the time. Like, I actually kind of got into it.
I think that this book is shockingly good for a first book attempt.
I was going to say, so I had thankfully already read other Jim Butcher stuff before coming to this book. As you know, if you're a regular listener on the book podcast, Rick made me suffer through the Codex Alera, and I ended up liking it. So
it was suffering through the first book, and then
for the first half of the first book, it was an actual torture.
Yes.
The second half of the first book, I was like, and by the third book, I was like, oh, I actually like this series. And I feel like that may be the situation with Dresden, only it's the whole first book is just, it's very much an amateurish book. Mm-hmm. Like, the villain is amateurish.
I'll give you that. Yeah.
The plot is solid. And so I found it very quick to read. I read most of it in just a couple of sittings, because his pacing is really good, which is something that Jim Butcher is good at. I feel like that's one of his natural It's certainly a strength that he's worked on a lot.
I think that it's especially a natural strength of his when he's doing first person.
Yes.
I think that when he got to doing a book that was in third person with multiple characters, he definitely
had a lot of trouble there.
Yeah. But with this book, especially being a first published book, I think that he really did an excellent job of carrying the reader through it. And I think that's a big part of what makes Dresden as a series so popular, despite it being, you know, especially early on, a flawed series in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But it's so easy to just pick up and breeze through that someone's like, okay, yeah, I'll grab the next one, whatever.
Right. And I think that's this book's real strength, is that by the end of it, you're like, I guess I don't mind reading the next one.
Yeah.
It's not that this book is good. I haven't read this book in 3 months, and I literally have it sitting beside me, and I'm looking through it, and I'm like, do I actually remember that happening? Kind of. Like, it's pretty forgettable, except for like the murder at the beginning is not forgettable. The
Toad demon scene.
That one.
Oh, really?
That one didn't stick for me.
Almost everyone remembers that one.
Like, Toad demon, when you mentioned it, I was like, oh yeah, there was a toad demon. Linda Randall, trying to seduce him when she was in the car, and then just
remember the,
and then just
the
like,
toad demon attacking him
and then
his
just
girlfriend.
Completely turning it off and being like, yeah, this is just my superpower. and then like turning around and getting murdered. That scene I remember. And then, him blowing up the restaurant, like blowing the doors off the restaurant.
Oh yeah.
That one is a good scene. And
the scorpion scene with the elevator. I think that
kind
of,
that was a really good scene.
But see, here's the thing. It was a good scene, but I didn't remember that it was Murphy. In my head, it's still Susan. So because there was the toad demon scene and the rain and the naked, like, all of that ended up getting compressed into giant cockroach thing that was in his desk. Like, toad demon, giant cockroach, falling. Mm. Like, all of that ended up being one scene now in my head. Like, because, again, two supernatural creature.
Sure.
Supernatural-ish creature. Like, yeah. So, it's not super memorable, but I remember going through it really quickly. There were some scenes for me. One, the way that he describes women especially tends to be very cliche in this book. I feel like the characters in general in this book, even compared to just Codex Alera or later books in this series, tends to be a little tropey.
Very much so.
That Karen is the tiny badass and Marcone is the lawful good or evil and not good. Not
Marcone
good
is
guys.
The monster,
like,
but the one
he's
that's
the,
easiest
the
to
well-dressed
with.
Monster yeah. and right. Bianca is the super sexy vampire.
Who's got a monster underneath that you really don't
you really don't want to mess with. You know, like, so
I think that Butcher is always going to lean hard into tropes though, because
there's
something to be
there's
said for
good
tropes.
About
like,
that.
They're fun.
Yeah. And they make it so that you, One of the important things of genre writing is that if you have enough of the tropes and you mess with them just a little bit, which he has messed with the urban fantasy tropes by having magic,
right,
like, you get something new and exciting and highly readable, because your readers don't have to learn an entire world.
Something that I think that Butcher does specifically well in this series is that he takes magic and demons and monsters and adds all of that into the real world in a way that is believable, that most authors, and really I would say all other urban fantasy authors, have not been able to do. Because to me, the Dresden universe feels like it could really be there and be in the real world, and no one would notice the supernatural entities.
And I said urban fantasy, but I was really thinking of more like detective novel genre. He's taken a lot of these detective novel, the hard-boiled
detective
tropes, including with the women, which, again, you'll hear me and Alana mostly make comments about, like, the way that he describes women, or the fact that Harry is just debilitatingly horny. But, like, he's taken a lot of these tropes from a different genre, moved into urban fantasy, and given us a world that is really believable. So that, I do feel like, is the strength of this first book.
I also do think that Harry's voice as a character is a big strength of the book, because you're in his head
I can definitely agree with that. I don't necessarily find his head a pleasant place to be as somebody who happens to have boobs. But
he'd be more into your earlobes.
You know, my earlobes are showing. One has to wonder. I don't know. She's got the short blonde hair. She's the earlobes of me.
That's true. I feel like that's the only... I don't know. I don't feel comparable to Murphy really at all.
You're not short at all.
No.
For those who don't know, Alana's almost 6 feet tall.
I'm 5'10".
I don't feel like you would punch me in any given situation. So that's not very Murphy-like.
Oh, I could see that, actually.
I could see it happening, but I don't see it happening in like every situation.
Right.
Fair. But yeah, I can't remember a time that
wound up
Murphy has ever actually punched Harry either.
Yeah, she definitely has.
Oh, when?
Oh, yeah.
She punches him in this book and in the next one.
Oh.
Yeah. And puts handcuffs on him.
She definitely handcuffs
him. Not in a fun way, by the way.
No.
But she...
He's very angry.
Murphy is... Okay, well, I want us to stick on Harry for a little while. I think it's entirely reasonable to criticize the way that women are talked about in this book. Although, I will also say that, especially coming off of some of the more recent reviews that we've done for the movie podcast, it is not nearly as bad as I think it really could be.
I think it can always be worse.
They're true. I think that
to be fair, we did read Court of Thorns.
Oh,
exactly. That's the one that does come to mind in terms of worseness. But I think that Harry is a person who he is debilitating and horny. That is absolutely true. It's a flaw
as evidenced by Linda Randall just like
easily
jerking him around.
Exactly. Just easily just, you know, taking him apart, essentially, just by being...
not even very sensual. Like...
Anyway, Harry is someone who is very much run by his glands. And it's a consistent flaw of his, but I think it is an intentional flaw. A lot of... I think lesser detective novels or that kind of thing would not present it as a flaw, but just simply as this is how everyone should be. And it never really comes back to bite them in any way.
Right.
With Harry, it is constantly on his ass biting him.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, a lot of the time you'll see the womanizer and like they're into him and he's into them. And the female gaze is also on Harry a lot of the time, which seems sometimes unnatural, but
I don't know. He is really tall.
Tall, but dark, and pretty scary if you see him from the outside.
Right.
I think.
And yeah, he cuts a unique figure. I guess.
It's when he opens his mouth and won't stop
exactly
like, referencing Spider-Man that you realize, oh, this guy isn't a tall, dark, scary wizard. He's a giant nerd.
Exactly. But I agree with you, Rick, that I appreciate that it's not just this, oh, he's the suave detective guy that all the women are into. Because, yeah, it really is an issue whether or not it's pleasant to read about.
Right. And I do think that was my point is like, I see him as a well-developed character. Mm-hmm. He's not necessarily a character's head I want to live in, right? Yeah. Because it is an uncomfortable experience as someone living in a female body to be inside of the head of someone that is literally objectifying anything with my body type.
Right.
Like, because to Harry's credit, he has no type.
all types,
all women, yeah,
are his type. If anything, he might be a little prejudiced against thicker girls, but I'm not convinced. Like,
I have no comment.
He definitely doesn't like children, so that's good.
That's good.
No,
he's not a predator.
But
I think even with the women that he sees, like, he is someone who is very attracted to women. And
yeah.
He's someone who's not getting any and who's very horny. So he notices it a lot. But I don't think that he's someone who is constantly trying to, like, get with women or trying to take advantage of situations.
Right. Right. He's not a womanizer.
He
has no game.
Right.
It's true. The one woman that he does manage to get with in
is the one that has game herself.
Right. Who has game herself and is also trying to get with him partly because it's a good story.
Right.
I'm sure there could be a column in the Midwestern Arcane of I dated a wizard and here's how it went.
Yep.
I ended up in a rainstorm almost getting eaten by a demon.
Right.
That is, I think, one of the most fun parts about that whole frog demon scene. So there's two potions down in the basement, and he tells her to go take one that it's the invisibility or something like
it's
that.
It's an escape potion.
Right.
You into the wind.
So he's trying to get her out of the situation. He's like, go drink it. It's in the sports bottle downstairs, and she grabs the love potion, of course.
Right.
But that's one of the things where it comes back to bite him, because then she's all into him, and he has to get them out of this situation where they're being attacked by a demon while she's like coming on to him.
Right.
I have no panties on, Harry.
That's not a
situation. He's also naked and definitely aroused.
Right.
And she is using that to her advantage. Honestly, like, that scene is written to be very funny.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at it in just mechanics, it is definitely assault.
I don't think that was intentional on his part at
all. No, it certainly wasn't intentional on his part. Right. And because of the potion, it wasn't intentional on her part.
Right.
But she was definitely making advances on him that he did not want.
Right.
And she would not stop.
Right.
Which is kind of the definition of inappropriate sexual contact.
Like, for sure.
Which, again, in this story was written to be funny. It's not really funny.
I think this scene is funny.
I found it funny, but I also, when I look at the mechanics, I'm like, if the genders had been reversed, mm-hmm. and he had been the one who took the love potion,
sure.
and she was the one having to be the wizard and fight him off, would it have been funny?
It depends for me at least greatly on what the accident that, like, why she has the love potion and what the accident that causes that to happen. It could be definitely played in a funny way. If it was this, like, level of he's on top of her, no. But if there's a horny guy that is, like, uncontrollably trying to get with a girl, like, the way to play that would instead be for him to be, like, doing the, like, hand on the shoulder, mid her trying to fight off the demon. Like,
right.
You could play it in a way that would be funny. You would just have to change the specifics of how it works. Right. And I think a part of that is that one purpose of this book is to titillate. And I don't think that is a bad thing. I think it is okay at points to play to the male sexuality, and that's not a bad thing. You, like, guys get horny too. We can. Everyone wants to enjoy some level of that, and I think that's part of what's going on in this scene. But I think it's important to make the distinction that some level of this is fantasy, but it's played for comedy, and it's never something that's portrayed as like, oh, this is a good thing that Susan is all over him and all of that. It's entirely a very difficult situation to deal with.
Right.
And all of it complicates Harry's life more rather than making it more fun. And I think
I think that is the important piece that is in this section that still does make me uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but it's not making his life better in any way.
Yeah. Right.
Although I guess he does end up with Susan in the end.
Yeah,
but
it's pretty
not because of this love potion.
It's not because of the love potion, and it's also in the moment very not clear that that's what's going to happen.
And when you have when you have this sleazy love potion, I think this is the only scene, the only scenario in which it can be, I don't know, used well. Like, even if it had been
an accident, that would have been completely
not
okay.
Right. And I think it bears mentioning that like Harry didn't set out to make a love potion at any point. Bob essentially blackmailed him into making it. And his intent was like, I'll just leave this here and it will go bad in a day or two. And there's no way I'm actually going to get to use this dumb thing. So, you know,
he does have a potions of, don't last very long. So
he does have a moment of like, well, Susan is always asking me to show her how magic works, but then he immediately dismisses the idea as thankfully. Like, no, I can't do that.
So, this wasn't a scene that struck me as like either party being very predatory just because it was, they're getting attacked by a giant toad demon.
Right. If
in anyone, a trench coat.
Right.
If anyone is predatory in this book, that strikes me that way, at least Victor. Victor, yeah, but he's not much of a character. I was going to bring up Linda. Linda uses her sexuality as a weapon in throughout this entire book.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, I think that Linda is an interesting character because the situation that she's in, she gets forced into, well, not really forced. She is in scenarios where her sexuality can be used as kind of a cudgel to knock Harry around in the head and keep him off balance. But as soon as we get a look past that, the one time that we do, when we see the inside of her apartment, Harry really relates to her as a person.
Yeah.
He sees like the empty pizza boxes, you know, in her house and he understands how lonely her life was and how both at times that could be comforting, many times it's not. And I think that's an interesting way to give some insight into a character that I think in a lot of lesser detective novels would just be a sexy dead body.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I appreciate that from him. And I think that Harry does largely go out of his way. Yes, he is very aware of how attractive the women are around him. But at pretty much the first opportunity, he will always see beneath that to the person that's there.
Yeah.
And I think that's a large part of why I'm not terribly, other than the fact that, you know, I am a guy and I also appreciate an attractive woman.
Right.
But I think that a big part of why it doesn't largely bother me throughout these books, why when Harry is doing that, is that he is very quick to see the person beneath that. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that. As soon as the direction gets out of his vision, he's like, oh yes, there is a human being there. But to talk about the other sexy character that I think is a lot of fun in this book, it's Bianca. Like I really think that she's an interesting character in this, even though I do agree that the direction her scene takes is a little, it's a little over the top, forced. What her reaction to
it. So I did want to talk about this scene just because, like, so Bianca is a vampire, and like vampires in many lores, at least her type of vampires is very sexy, and so she runs a brothel, like, and she has beautiful women and probably beautiful men,
mm-hmm.
Who work as sex workers, and her brothel is extremely well regarded in the city. Like, she has high class clients, high class workers. And Jennifer Stanton is one of her girls. Mm-hmm. And Marcone's guy is one of her regular clients. Right. So she is pissed that Jennifer is dead.
Right.
And she thinks Harry did it.
Right.
Like, she thinks he's the only one that would be capable of killing her girl. And so, like, when Harry shows up to ask questions, she's immediately accusatory.
Right.
And Harry forces his power on her, essentially.
Mm-hmm. It's not quite that. She isn't instantly, like, in full attack mode. They very much are sparring verbally at the beginning. And he gets to a point where he pushes that. She thinks that he thinks he killed her. And she comes over the table at him, and he pulls out a handkerchief that has a sunbeam in it, which is bad for vampires.
Yes.
Right.
Well, at least for her type.
Right.
Then she turns into a bat monster.
Right.
Yeah. So what struck me as a little extreme, and this will show up later, which is why I say it's a little extreme, she has to recover her flesh. So once a vampire loses their flesh suit, essentially, they have to eat in order to heal.
I mean, that uses some power. She doesn't have to do it to get it back. She gets it back and then is immediately hungry afterwards.
But it uses energy.
Yes, yeah.
She's going to have to eat after doing all of the work to get her face back on.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like, and again, that's just common vampire lore. If a vampire gets injured, they heal really rapidly, but then they are desperately hungry.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so that's what happens. He throws a sunbeam at her because he felt threatened. She was threatening him.
She was trying to kill him, so understandable.
And she then has been seen as she is, mm-hmm. and she doesn't like that. She wants to be perceived as a beautiful, sexy human woman.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so she has been revealed, and that just like breaks something in her relationship with Harry to me.
It's not just right. that. So she does need to feed. And when she feeds, she picks one of her... You don't find this out in this book. It's something okay. that comes mm-hmm. up more in Grave Peril. But she feeds on one of her people, and she loses control and kills her in the process.
Right.
Which is clear in this one.
That's pretty clear in this one.
Right.
Yeah.
But what isn't clear to me is why she then builds a vendetta against
right.
Harry. Which mm-hmm. becomes clear in the later novels that, like, because... he revealed her true face and she had to fix it. And then she lost control when she was feeding because she was so hungry and mm-hmm. killed her own pretty person. Mm-hmm. Like, she now has this vendetta against Harry. She sends out in this book a line that just says regret. Like, I'm going to make you regret right. this. And she does.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, she does.
Eventually. But like, she then goes into like full on planning a mission to take Harry Dresden mm-hmm. down mode because she drank one of her girls.
I think that
seems a little extreme.
Well, yeah, but what good is a villain if they're not a little extreme?
Okay, yeah. okay.
But a big part of it is that loss of control. With Red Court vampires specifically, control is very much, your ability to control your hunger is very much a social position mechanic. Mm-hmm. It's one of their like most prized attributes in their nobles. And so by forcing her to use
forcing her
into a situation where she lost control, essentially,
right,
she blames Harry for her loss of control, and that's a big social no-no for them specifically. And mm-hmm. so
sure, and you can definitely explain that right. when you're two or three or four books yeah. in. The problem is this book specifically, I felt like her reaction did not meet my expectation mm-hmm. for the situation when I was reading mm-hmm. it in this book alone. Like, right. do I love what he ends up doing with this? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Like, the third book is probably my favorite of sure. the one that I've read so far. Still not a great book, but my favorite of the one I've read so far. Mm-hmm. Like, but... in this book, if this were a standalone book, Bianca just felt too, like, she felt a little bit like Victor. Just too extreme for the situation.
I would say that for me, the difference between her and Victor, and I would like to talk about Victor and kind of that to wrap up things. Mm-hmm. But I think the difference for me and Victor is that she is intended to be there for a one-off scene that will further complicate Harry's life at some point. But right. It doesn't right now, and he doesn't really know exactly what he's done to... he knows what he's done, but he doesn't understand the depth of what, like, insult what he's given her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an interesting way to play that scene. I can understand why you could take it as, like, okay, that's a way over-the-top reaction for what he did.
Yeah.
But for me, that scene plays differently. But again, I don't remember what my initial reaction was to it, not knowing all right. the background and all mm-hmm. that kind
of
stuff.
And I think part of this... is me coming in as someone who doesn't read series, yeah. whereas you are someone who mm-hmm. does read series, and Alana, you also read series. Mm-hmm. So I have really only read series because of this podcast. Mm-hmm. It's not something that I do on purpose. In general, I'll read like the first book or two of a series and even then still not be hooked enough that I'll read the rest. Like, it's just not my thing, at least not right now. I did finally enjoy a series with Codex. But if it hadn't been for you, I might not have finished it. Like, right. And it's going to be the same with these. And it has been the same throughout my whole life. If somebody gives me the books, oh yeah, sure. I'm not going to pursue a series. Right. And so because of that, I do look at stories as standalones, mm-hmm. even within a series. Mm-hmm. And this one to me is pretty good mm-hmm. for setting up a new series
yeah.
and right. not as good as a standalone.
Yeah.
Like,
I think that...
which I think may be on purpose, but doesn't work for someone who's a reader like me.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably true. I think that when he initially wrote this, he intended as a book that could just work on its own, but also had the ability to yeah. go on for further than that.
Right. And I feel like he did one of those two things better than the other.
That's fair.
I will say the vampire scene specifically, having only read the first and second book so far... that one didn't strike me as that strange. I don't know. It partially because I was really focused on the whole thing of Harry being aroused by the vampire drinking of the young girl, but also
that part was really awkward.
That it's interesting to hear because I think we had very different reactions, and I'm like, oh, I'm 3 months out, but I remember a lot of this book actually.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and specifically that scene, I was not as I guess surprised by the reaction of the vampiress. I don't know.
I mean, she is a vampire.
Yeah, they're not known for being cuddly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Or she's, not vengeful.
She's intense.
Yeah.
And, yep.
And that's kind of what I went into it expecting. And so I wasn't caught off guard.
Let's talk a little bit about Victor, and then we'll go into final thoughts.
Yeah.
I think Victor is the biggest weak point of this book. And I wonder if that's partly because he's largely not in this book. This being a detective novel, you really don't get a face-off with the villain until very late in the story.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think that because of that, you largely lack a lot of the insight about him that makes a lot of these other characters interesting. Because so many times in this book, you get a look at this character through Harry's eyes, and then you get to see the layers under that and see the like things that Harry was wrong about them, or the things that Harry wouldn't have expected about them. With Victor, he's pretty much a card carrying like bad dialogue villain from the get go, he never really gets a scene that explains him, other than the scene from Monica that kind of shows his descent into madness through her eyes. Mm-hmm. But that's largely a scene that talks about Monica more than it does about him in a lot of ways.
I mean, he's very much just the guy who's been consumed by black magic.
Yes.
Right.
And so, okay, well, maybe he was a person at one point, but now he's not.
Yeah. Now he's just a monster, in a human suit. and it's unfortunate, I think, because he could be a very memorable, interesting character.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But largely his dialogue is such like over the top.
It's so cliche.
Oh yeah.
It's absolutely cliche. And I think that is just a straight up flaw. Like I could see it being a outgrowth of of the black magic and all of that. Mm-hmm. But I think it's just he's not a very well written character at the end of the day. But I do appreciate the complications of like the giant scorpions and the fact that he's faced those before. So he knows sort of what to expect with that. And then summoning the demon again, I think it's in terms of a final conflict fight, all of this functions pretty well,
right?
By bringing all of the elements that Harry has faced before into this one moment.
Definitely.
But it's just, it doesn't have a lot of impact because at the end of the day, I don't care that Victor loses.
Yeah.
Right. I actually opened to the section where he's fighting Victor just to look at the dialogue, and it literally like, Victor, you, he shouted. You bastard, Victor screamed. Like, I mean, these are just golden lines, guys. Yes,
exactly.
Like,
And I think part of the disappointment is that he does a lot of the other tropes so well such a way that Marcone and Murphy, all those people, they're almost inevitable characters, and they're they're fleshed out and they're there. And then you're expecting Victor to be some more fleshed out version of this trope.
Right.
And even the whole lead up to that scene is really good. He's driving down the Lake Michigan coast. There's a storm coming. He has to beat the storm or Victor will get all the energy from it. He gets to the house even, and he like opens his third eye. He can see all the evil dripping over the house. I think that's a really good description. And then you walk in and there's this, you bastard. It's really pathetic.
I do agree with that entirely. I think anytime he opens up the third eye,
those are definitely some of my favorite places, because he can't get rid of those images too. So he knows whatever he sees,
it's with him.
He will have a permanent, indelible memory.
He's really glad he didn't look at the demon in this one, because that would be real bad.
Oh,
and I can tell you later on, he looks at some stuff that he should not have. It was a bad call.
No.
But
just that contrast of, you got all this cool setup, and then you've
and
got...
And then the victor.
Actually, there's no... Yeah, he's honestly just kind of an angsty teenager. Like, it's... Yeah.
Appreciate that he mostly overcame that flaw in pretty much every book after that. But in this one, just the villain is pathetic.
And I was going to say, we reviewed the second book last time, and one of the things you said you didn't like is that the plot is basically
really
the same.
Yeah.
But I think he does it so much better because you have the FBI guys from the very beginning. You have all the yeah, you have all the setup, and right. of course there's the reveal at the end. But there's so much more history.
I think there's definitely things about the second book that are definitely absolutely better than this one. Mm-hmm. But I think as a whole package, and I guess I can kind of lead into my final thoughts with this. But I think as a whole package, this book is just largely better in terms of like, it's just so readable. This book is so easy to cruise through. And I think that's down to the fact that Harry is outside of his objectifying gaze. He's just a very charming person and kind of a nice guy to be in, even though he does have his darker moments. He's not, there's so many facets to Harry. He's not just a wisecracking goofball. He's also not just a broody, wizardly asshole. There's always shades to him, and he's surprisingly thoughtful and surprisingly, he has a lot of surprising depth to the thought that he puts into the world around him.
Right.
But he's also just damn funny. Like, it's fun to be in a head with him and Bob bickering back and forth, or him and Murphy when they're in a good mood bickering back and forth.
Right.
And I think that that's the biggest strength of this book. It's my favorite part about this book is just Harry's head. I think that if you listen to the audiobook, James Marsters really brings that to life. But Harry,
really got to listen to one of his.
I definitely recommend it. But Harry is just, he's a blast. He's fun to be in. He's fun to be around. He has definite flaws, but I think for the most part, those flaws enhance his character and make him more believable and more human. Mm-hmm. The worst part about this book is absolutely Victor. Victor's just not fun. He's not interesting.
We may all say that.
He's basically everything that the reverse of everything I said about Harry. There's nothing particularly interesting to him about him. The best scene about Victor is one that he's not in, and it's when his wife is talking about her, like the descent into madness that he went through and how it affected her.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just it's a very tragic, heartbreaking scene. Mm-hmm. But then you get to him and he's like, rah! A monster, rah!
And you're like, we need to put you down.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. He's something that needs to be put down. There's no nuance to it at all.
No.
No. There's no tragedy to him. If there was a tragic feeling of like, this guy was once just a completely ordinary family man and now he's this, that would be that would be interesting. If he was the Walter White of this story, that I think would work a lot better. But unfortunately he's not. The first time I read this book, I didn't instantly love The Dresden Files. It wasn't one of those series where it's like, oh, this is definitely going to be my favorite series of all time. I read this book and I was like, oh, that was fun. And my brother happened to have the second book on his shelf. So I was like, okay, I'm going to take that and I'm going to read this next one. And I'm glad I did because it got so much better than this. But this still isn't a great book. I'm going to give this 3 out of 5 bad combinations of potions because it's very fun. But I think that it's entirely reasonable, Michael, that you would forget everything that happens in it after a relatively short period of time. But I also think that there are things that are very
memorable. There are some standout scenes.
Yeah. Mm. But overall, it's a piece of popcorn fiction. You pop it in, you enjoy it for a second, and it can be gone. Mm-hmm. Or you can go on with the rest of the series and watch Butcher develop and grow as a writer and Harry develop and grow as a character. And I think that really in fiction, Harry is one of the most interesting characters to watch develop out there because you get such a granular level to that and it's still believable. But I've gushed enough. So, Alana?
Yeah, so least favorite part, or I guess I should start with favorite like you did. Yeah, I also...
We mix it up.
Okay. I don't know. I'd say my favorite part was definitely just the readability of it. Because I breezed through it and I enjoyed it. And I think there's just a lot of potential as his first book in there. You see these good descriptions. You see the really good pacing. Mm-hmm. Just the characters that seem so inevitable. I don't know, that's the word that keeps coming back to me for them because they're tropes, but they're just so fleshed out, especially the main characters.
They're such well done tropes that it excuses
exactly.
The tropiness.
Like John Marcone is honestly
moves away from the cliche. It's a trope, but it's not necessarily cliche. Yeah.
John Marcone's honestly probably my favorite side character in this series. I love him. Yeah, he's fantastic. So just all of that, building a really readable story. Least favorite part, I'm not going to say Victor. This is a tiny thing. Okay. The fact that he uses random exclamations in his prose.
Okay.
That like bothers me. Yeah, it's the Hell's Bells specifically. I don't know what it is, but he's like, you know, he's driving and bad things are happening. All of a sudden, Hell's Bells. And I'm just, I don't know. It just really, really rubs me the wrong way. But
That's going to keep coming. So
yeah, I know it is. I know it is. And that is, of course, part of Harry, but it's still, I don't know. It kind of, I wince every time I read that.
Sure.
Yeah. So I would also give it 3 out of 5 this time. Yeah. 3 out of 5 exploding restaurants.
All right.
Ooh. Yeah. That's a good one. Yeah. All right. So my final thoughts. I agree with both of you on things to bother in these, in the story, and things to like in this story. Hell's Bells doesn't bother me. However, there, and I can't remember if it's in this book or the second book, but he breaks the third wall and refers to you like as the reader.
Oh, like just as a, yeah.
Like
yeah.
randomly. It's only like once.
Yeah.
And it just threw me so bad. It was something like, don't you dare judge me. And I was just like, where is this coming from? Yeah. You have not broken the third wall at all.
Right.
Yeah. So that's similar to me to the Hell's Bells thing. Mm-hmm. I think that's in the second book, not this one though. So favorite things. See, I don't remember what I said on the first podcast because I did have some things that stood out. So coming at it from a, it's been 3 months or 6 months or however long it's been since I read it, and what still stands out to me, I would say that must mean that my favorite things are his descriptions. Mm-hmm. Because, and this is something I've seen Butcher do well in general, he has a very casual style that somehow still allows me to see a whole world, mm-hmm. which is difficult to do. I've read authors, I mean, I've read very widely, and I've read authors that just pile on pages and pages of description, and you can definitely see every detail, mm-hmm. But it can feel really overwhelming.
Right.
Butcher mm-hmm. is not like that. Not in this book, for sure, because it's a first-person narrative, mm-hmm. And yet I always feel like I can see everything. Like mm-hmm. I know where I am in the world. I know what's around me. I know when he's driving. I know when he's walking. Like, and that's difficult with a first person book in general mm-hmm. to give a sense of what things look like. But he does a really good job in this book with that. And I always felt like I could tell where things were, except for maybe in the scene in the lake house. There were some places where I was like, is there a balcony inside the house?
Right.
What caught on fire there?
Yeah.
Like, but minor tweaks with that. So I think my favorite stuff from a distance is definitely the world building within a first person narrative where I really feel like I can see what's going on.
Sure.
Least favorite part. I do agree with you that Victor is the worst villain in this series. Like Bianca is a much scarier person. Marcone is a much scarier person.
Yeah.
And as sub villains, they were much more interesting than mm-hmm. the actual main villain. But I think my least favorite part was when I read it the first time, because this is a mystery and the villain was not revealed until the very end, mm-hmm. there were a number of scenes where I was like, but why does this matter? Right. Because the two narratives felt disconnected.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even though they did end up being connected and mm-hmm. he did a good job by the end of being like, see, look, this is how they all go together.
Right.
In the middle, where I really should have been feeling everything close in, there were a number of times where I was like, okay, now he's with Cells. Now he's with Linda. Now he's with the Murphy case. Mm-hmm. And it just, I kept being like, but why does this scene matter?
He hadn't built up the faith to go, okay, this will definitely tie in something.
Exactly. Right. I hadn't picked up, and again, part of this is just me as a reader and me not reading a ton of mysteries, but I had not picked up on enough of the threads to put it together myself.
Right.
And so I was just like, I don't get why there are still two stories
right.
in the middle. Yeah. So that's probably my least favorite part. And I think it's why now that I'm further out from it, the two big kind of demon scenes, mm-hmm. the toad demon and then the cockroach or
scorpion.
Yes. Giant scorpion, not cockroach. And the giant scorpion kind of got blended in my head because I couldn't quite figure out how the two stories went together. Right. By the time I got to the end and they did go together, my brain was just like, oh, merge all of the stuff.
In yeah, right. That makes yes. sense.
So I think that's probably my least favorite thing. Overall rating. I didn't hate it and it read up really quickly and I looked forward to reading the second one, but I'm still only going to give it 2.5 giant scorpions in an elevator out of 5.
Yeah.
Maybe only a 2,
I
but
that's entirely
reasonable. 2.5.
Yeah.
It's just a middle of the run book. Yeah. Like, give it to your friends. Tell them, hey, you're sick. Here, read this in bed.
Right. Like, it's sort of like giving someone a watermelon flavored treat and being like, hey, if you like this, maybe you'll like the real thing when it gets better.
Right.
But
it doesn't actually taste like watermelon.
Exactly. I think that you can see a lot of the potential here, but it's potential. Mm-hmm. It's still definitely not realized.
It's definitely a first book. There are some.
But we've read a lot of first books in this book. In this, but for
it's
this.
Nowhere close to as bad as Dragonhaven, and that was like a 10th book. So
there you go. Exactly.
There you go.
Well, all that said, I don't have a good way to lead out, so I should have come up with a better outro, but I didn't. So here we are. You can find more of us at www.opinionatedpodcast.com. We do movie reviews and, as you can tell, book reviews. You can find us on Twitter if you want to yell at me, probably specifically, about my opinions on Harry and these books.
I may be back on Twitter soon. I'll let you know.
All right. Good deal. You can also find us at on our email at opinionatedmoviereviews@gmail.com if you have a suggestion for a movie or a book that you would like to hear us talk about. Other than that, if you could go leave us a review on iTunes or go follow us on Spotify or go tell a friend about the podcast if you enjoyed it. Those are the best ways we have to reach out to new listeners, and we always appreciate that you would do that. So until next time,
we're opinionated.